So then we continue in the ministry of the prophet Ezekiel. As I said, several months ago, we considered the first 11 chapters. And as I went through that series, I wondered whether anybody was going to come up to me and ask me whether it was significant that I, as a psychiatrist, had chosen to speak on this bizarre prophet Ezekiel with all his strange behaviours. And then as I was preparing this sermon, well, not quite as I was preparing this sermon, but in the period when I was preparing this sermon and I opened my British Journal of Psychiatry, I was, in the providence of the Lord, found then an article entitled, Did Ezekiel Have Catatonia? Did Ezekiel have catatonia? Catatonia being a form of schizophrenia. And that is one article in a long series of articles of literature in psychiatry, psychology and psychoanalysis that have looked at this man and considered that he must have had some form of mental illness. And all kinds of speculations as to what form of mental illness he had then have occurred. So there's catatonia, based on what I commented on a little earlier, that as we saw in chapters 4 and 5, he was rendered, and for years of his ministry, was rendered dumb and immobile as a prophet of the Lord. And since catatonia in schizophrenia renders people for long periods of time unable to speak and of limited and sometimes no movement at all, then it was thought, well, maybe Ezekiel was suffering from catatonia, and other speculation has had manic depression, psychotic depression and so on, because he's a man who sees visions, he's a man who has out-of-body experiences, he's a man who talks to things that aren't there, like mountains hundreds of miles away in Israel. Surely this man was not in his right mind, think so many of my colleagues. But of course, we know then that all these experiences and this behaviour was brought about by the Lord, that the Lord imposed that immobility on his servant the prophet, that the Lord rendered him dumb and only able for about 6 years to speak when God told him to, that the Lord lifted him out of his human body in some experience we can't understand and transported him to Ezekiel for that set of experiences we considered in chapters 8 to 11. That all these things then were brought about because Ezekiel had this special ministry, a unique ministry for the Lord, unique as I commented earlier because it took place in Babylon, uniquely then a prophet of the Lord carrying out his ministry entirely outside the Holy Land. And called then to minister time after time, a ministry that for years was a ministry, as we've already seen, of doom and woe for the people of Judah, particularly then for Jerusalem, threatening it as he did time after time as the Lord's mouthpiece with destruction. And as I said then, this evening, we come to more bizarre behaviour from Ezekiel, don't we? The first parts of chapter 12 that we've read, we have two more of these sign acts, two more times then when Ezekiel, at the Lord's command, carries out a strange pattern of behaviour in silence because he's rendered dumb before his wife, before other onlookers, wondering what he is doing. And as I intimated earlier then, this part in chapter 12 has a theme that runs through chapter 12 into chapter 13 and chapter 14. A theme then linked together by prophecy, by the ministry of true prophets like Ezekiel, of false prophets, and of the attitude of the elders and the people to prophecy and the prophets amongst them. And I want to try and draw out five features of true compared with false prophecy, or true versus false prophets, from these chapters this evening. But remembering, of course, that as the Apostle Peter says in his second letter, that whilst we do not have a true prophecy today, well, there are no true prophets of the Lord ministering. And so Peter can say that just as there were false prophets among the people, there will be false teachers among you. And so the lines of application for us will dwell on false teaching compared with true teaching based on this pattern that we see then in Ezekiel. So we have then, first of all, in chapter 12, Ezekiel, the true prophet of the Lord. And as I've said then, he has two more of these sign acts that we've seen several of before. First of all, from verse 3, he is told to pack up for exile. Apparently, Exiles had something that they used to call an exile bag or sack, which was probably something a bit like one of those Santa Claus bags that you see in pictures that you would carry over your shoulder. So that when Ezekiel and his fellow exiles had been deported those years previously with Jehoiakim, then they would have had to grab together as many belongings as they thought they could carry, stick them all in their exile bag to carry off to Babylon. And so here then, Ezekiel is told to pack up his belongings, to get hold of his exile bag from somewhere where he had dumped it in his hut, to gather up various belongings, and to go outside. And he would have been for some period of time, as I've said, not moving. His wife would suddenly have seen him moving. The word would have gone round his village, and people would have thought, something's happening again with this prophet. He's doing something, and they'd have observed him then going out. They would then later, at the end of the day, have observed him digging a hole back into his hut. That whatever he lived in was some kind of mud, clay brick structure. Not sure exactly what it looked like, but clearly he could dig his way back in. And he was commanded by the Lord to dig a hole, then go back in, drag his sack back inside again. And then at dusk, when it was almost dark, he crawled back out through the hole again, put it over his shoulder and marched off into the darkness before all the onlookers wondering, what is he doing? And at some point later that night, he returned home. And the next morning, then we read the Lord saying, didn't they ask you then, Ezekiel? Didn't they ask you what this was all about? And Ezekiel then is enabled to speak. His mouth is opened and he interprets his actions for the exiles. His actions were not clear by themselves. Clearly somebody was leaving and going somewhere, but who was it that was departing? Maybe the optimists would have said, we're going to go home. If they'd listened to Ezekiel's earlier ministry, they should have been pretty clear that wasn't going to be the case. And that, as Ezekiel says, it wasn't the case. That what he was saying was those remaining in Jerusalem are going to be packing their exile bags, and they're all going to be, if they survive, they're all going to be carted off like you were. There's no future there. And that the king, or Ezekiel, in fact, deliberately refrains from using the word king because he doesn't like to call Zedekiah, he doesn't recognize him as a true king. He just calls him a prince. He says, the prince is going to have to do that as well. He's going to have an exile bag. He's going to be crawling out through a hole in the wall and running for his life. And he's going to be covering his face. Ezekiel was commanded to cover his face so that he wouldn't see the land. Well, says Ezekiel, when that so-called king, that pseudo-king Zedekiah, tries to flee, he's going to be captured and he won't see the land. He's going to be taken to Babylon and he won't see it. Because as we see in the historical fulfillment, you may remember that Zedekiah, when he was captured by the Babylonians, was blinded. So he didn't see the land. Just as Ezekiel was, as it were, rendered blind and unable to see the land as he acted out the role of Zedekiah. But also, of course, as we've seen before, Ezekiel in his sign act serves more than one role, doesn't he? He serves also the role of the Lord's judgment. The tunneling into his hut pictures the Babylonians breaking through the wall into Jerusalem. They are the instruments of the Lord. The Lord himself breaking through. That created the hole through which Zedekiah could in fact escape or attempt to escape. But as Ezekiel prophesied, the Lord would spread his Babylonian net in verse 13. He would spread his net and he would capture this pseudo-king trying to flee and punish him in this way. And all the people too then who survived, they would be dispersed, scattered, the survivors then, taken into exile. A few of them would survive. A few of them would be spared the sword, famine, and plague, and made to confess that the Lord is God. So that's Ezekiel's first sign act here. And then the second one, very briefly described in verses 17 and 18, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, tremble as you eat your food, and shudder in fear as you drink your water. So we don't know how soon after this packing for exile sign act, but again, Ezekiel then was told by the Lord to sit there so that people could see what he was doing. And what he was doing was spilling his drink, slopping his food all over the place because he was trembling in fear. And the Lord then tells him again to speak to the people, to interpret this, say to the people living in the land. He ironically calls them the people of the land, the people of the Holy Land. And it's irony because he's just said, you're not going to be there anymore. You're going to be taken out from the land. They're no longer the people of the land. But he ironically calls them the people of the land. Well, say to those people then currently in, those Jews currently back there, they're going to be like you, trembling in fear, hardly able to eat their food and drink their water because of all the violence the Babylonians are going to bring upon the land. I'm going to lay it waste. The language of verse 20 is drawn from Leviticus 26 and the covenant curse of God emptying the people from the land and leaving it desolate. And Ezekiel says, now is the time when this is going to happen. And so these two sign acts and their interpretations, of course, are part of the theme that we've seen earlier in Ezekiel, haven't we? We've seen his earlier ministry has been that Jerusalem is to be destroyed, that the people will be wiped out, the temple razed to the ground. They will be carted into exile and only a remnant would survive. But the rest of chapter 12 then gives the people's response to Ezekiel's ministry from verse 21. We have a couple of sayings that were in circulation about prophetic ministry. So Ezekiel's come then, he's carried out this painful ministry, these sign acts, he's prophesying for the Lord what he's going to do. And what are the people saying? Well, in verse 22, the first proverbial saying going round is, the days go by and every vision comes to nothing. The days go by and every vision comes to nothing. And then the second saying in verse 27. The vision he sees is for many years from now. And he prophesies about the distant future. And to these sayings then that were going round, Ezekiel's response or the Lord's response through Ezekiel is to say, it's going to be soon. They will be fulfilled what I've spoken through Ezekiel. It is going to happen. Don't you worry about these sayings, Ezekiel, that are going round. But what this illustrates then is the first point then about the ministry of Ezekiel and about prophecy. And it is cynicism. These people have a cynical response to Ezekiel. They've heard him prophesy. They've seen him carry out these sign acts for so long, for months and years now. And they say, well, nothing's happened. Nothing's happened, Ezekiel. But more than that, their cynicism is fueled by the way they lump together Ezekiel with the false prophets, as we would call them. They lump his ministry together. We see that from verse 24, where the Lord said, there will be no more false visions or flattering divinations amongst the people of Israel. And the fact that in verse 13, we continue with the ministry of the false prophets. So these people are listening to Ezekiel. But there are these other men prophesying around in these villages in exile. And like Jeremiah, back in the Holy Land. They're prophesying things as well. They're listening to Ezekiel and they're watching him perform. But they're watching these other men perform as well. And these people, they're cynical. They're all these prophets, you know. These prophets, they're all the same. These prophets, you can't believe them. These prophets, whatever they say, well, nothing ever happens anyway, does it? Look at Ezekiel, he's prophesied for years about Jerusalem and its doom, and it's still there. He's told us for years that there's going to be a complete deportation of Judah, and it's never happened. And so this, as I say, is a cynical attitude that we have here of the people to the true ministry of the word through Ezekiel. That Ezekiel, as far as they were concerned, his ministry was indistinguishable from that of what we call the false prophets, who are, as we've seen in chapter 13, prophesying out of their own imaginations. Just as, of course, today, the ministry of the truth, the ministry of the gospel through Christian people, through ministers of the word, is just lumped together with all other kinds of religious teaching by people outside, all viewed or cynically is lumped together as the same kind of thing. These Mormons and these evangelicals and these Buddhists and these Hindus, they're all the same, these religious people, aren't they? And what they say doesn't really matter. It never has any real impact on the world. Doesn't it make any difference which one you believe or don't believe? It's all the same. Now, of course, when we hear those kinds of things as evangelical Christians, we think, this is absolutely ridiculous. How can people possibly say this? How can they possibly say that Mormonism is the same as evangelical Christianity or that Islam is somehow the same as Christianity? It's absurd. They're obviously different. And of course they are to us. Of course they're obviously different to us. Just as Ezekiel's ministry was obviously different to the true people of God. They knew he was a true prophet of the Lord. But that didn't stop the mass of the cynical people with their hardened, unbelieving hearts from discounting him, from cynically lumping him together. And this then lumping together of us, when from our point of view it seems so clear that this is the ministry of the truth, of the true gospel that people need, this is nothing new. This is the hard-hearted or blindness of wicked people to the truth, their refusal to try to distinguish what obviously to us is different. The people of Ezekiel's day, the comfortable thing, the easy thing is just to say, it's all the same and none of it matters. But of course it did matter, didn't it? It mattered greatly if you were Jews in Jerusalem at this time, whether you listened to Ezekiel and other true prophets like Jeremiah, because if you did, then you would know that the Lord was going to destroy Jerusalem. That the wise, the proper thing to do was to submit to the Babylonians, was to go over to them and to accept that it was the Lord's will that Jerusalem was to be destroyed. And then your life would be saved and that of your family. But if you were amongst the cynics, the cynical mass, and you didn't, you stayed in Jerusalem and you suffered then the vengeance of the Lord from resulting then from your cynicism, just as people today, by not wanting to investigate because of their hard heart and their blind eyes. They don't want to try to distinguish truth from error. They don't want to try to distinguish evangelical truth from all this other religious teaching. And that too, of course, leaves them in a perilous state, doesn't it? They remain then under the wrath of God. They remain in danger of hell. So it's a sad reality then, though, that the ministry of truth down the ages through men like Ezekiel is just confused, lumped together cynically by unbelievers in dismissing it then by saying, well, you know, it's all the same. It's all the same, these true prophets. Well, they wouldn't call them true prophets. The ministry of all the prophets, it's all the same. And none of it ever happens. Well, it was a short time after, it was a few years later, and it did come to fulfillment, and as we'll see, Ezekiel's ministry was vindicated. So the first thing then about prophecy, and particularly the attitude to it, is often that, or the attitude to truth and God's truth is often cynicism, a deliberate cynical confounding of the truth with error. But we move then into chapter 13, where, as I said, when we were reading, we have, first of all, the ministry of what we would call false prophets, these men prophesying out of their own imaginations. And then at the end of the chapter, from verse 17, the ministry of prophetesses or witches, females who were carrying out a false ministry. So first of all, then, the men in the first part of the chapter, whom Ezekiel, the Lord, dismisses as jackals, as whitewashers of walls. And in an extended picture then that Ezekiel uses in these first verses, he likens the people of God to a wall. He likens the people of God to a wall, but a wall that's in great need of repair. It's a damaged wall. It's a fragile wall. And it needs to be repaired. It needs men who would then, as it were, come with the truth and rebuild the wall with true ministry. But instead there are all these jackals, these prophets prophesying out of their own imaginations. And what are they doing? Well, they're coming along, says Ezekiel, and they're whitewashing the wall. They're just plastering over it. They're not rebuilding it. There's no proper mortar and bricks and substance in there. It's just a covering, a veneer, a whitewash. In fact, the Ezekiel's language, as so often, is very clever. The Hebrew word he uses that's translated as whitewash is a word that could also mean vanity or emptiness. So what he's saying is these false prophets, they come along with these things they're inventing or their own ideas, and they just cover it with this emptiness. They whitewash, they hogwash, as one of the commentators says. They hogwash the wall. It's a load of nonsense that they put up there. It's not true. It's false teaching. It's error. It's vanity. False prophecy. But that's what they plaster, as it were, all over this wall. Or in part of it, Ezekiel likens the wall then to something with a hole in, that the prophets should be defending the wall, defending the people. But they're not there defending, they're not standing defending. These false prophets aren't interested in defending, they're only interested in pretending that all is well. In as it were, taking this wall that's about to fall down and making it look fine, in covering it with whitewash and saying all is well. Prophesying then, teaching, bringing teaching that makes people comfortable and at ease. But as we read midway through the chapter from verse 13 onwards, very clearly, in fact from verse 10, though they're saying peace and they're saying all is well in verse 10, they're saying peace, but there isn't peace because the Lord, he says, the Lord is going to come. He's going to come like a great storm, a huge torrent. A great flood is going to smash down upon this flimsy wall that should have been made sturdy and strong and going to completely destroy it. And this wall then is the sovereign Lord's judgment. He is going to come in his wrath. We read in verse 13, in my wrath I will unleash a violent wind, and in my anger hailstones and torrents of fury will fall with destructive, torrents of rain will fall with destructive fury. I will tear down the wall you have covered with whitewash, and so on. So again, this wall, the people, as it were, or Jerusalem in a mixed metaphor, is going to be destroyed by the Lord because the false prophets have prophesied peace. They have brought a ministry that was comfortable and at ease. And related to this ministry of the men then was this women's ministry that we read of from verse 17. These women also uttered prophecy out of their own imagination, as we read in verse 17. But also they engaged in magic, what we would, I guess, call black magic. That they, we read, sewed magic charms on all their wrists and made veils of various lengths for their heads. Now, it's not clear exactly what these things were, what was being referred to by these things for their wrists and these things for their heads. We don't know exactly what they looked like or what they were, but it's clear what their function was. Their function was that these were objects that had magical power. A belief so common then that through the manipulation of physical objects, you can affect the world around us. That perhaps particularly in association with a magical charm, a saying, some kind of incantation, and you say the right words that this woman gives you, you put on this amulet on your wrist, and you can ward off evil. You can defend yourself against the evil day, or maybe as with voodoo practice and sticking needles in dolls, you can inflict harm on your enemies. But the basic belief was then, if you went to these women, you could get your will sorted out. You can manipulate the world around you. And like the ministry of the men, the prophets who are bringing this whitewash, this comfortable teaching, then these women also then, they were supported by the people. They're paid for their ministry. As you read in verse 19, you profaned me among my people for a few handfuls of barley and scraps of bread. They're paying then for this ministry. They come along, they give their money to the prophets, the prophetesses, and they get the result that they want. They get a comfortable message. They get the message that all is well when disaster looms. And this then is a second aspect of a false prophetic ministry and false teaching ministry then, that it is characteristically comfortable teaching. It is comfortable. This is then what they did. They would whitewash. It was peace. Everything was fine. It looked great. It's like today, you know, somebody doesn't go to the local astrologer or the clairvoyant or the palmist, and they go in they sit down, and she says to them, "Yes, the year ahead is going to be hard for you. You're going to lose your job. You're going to contract a horrible, painful illness. Your wife is going to sue you for divorce. Now, can I have my £5, please?" It doesn't work like that, does it? You pay your money and you get a message that fits, a message that you want. And so it was in these days. So it has always been. It's part of the ministry of, or the nature of, false teaching, false prophecy, that it brings what the itching ears want to hear. It says peace when there is no peace. It doesn't come along and say, "You're in great danger. You Jews, Jerusalem is going to be destroyed." It doesn't come along to people today and say, "You are wicked for that practice. That you divorcing your wife is wickedness." It doesn't come along and say that you being drunk deserves punishment from God. People come along with comfortable teaching, with this whitewashed teaching. And we need to be aware that this, of course, happens within Christian ministry as well. I remember some years ago listening to a theologian commenting on the teaching of 19th century liberals. And in the late 19th century and early 20th century, apparently, there was a great trend for publishing books on Jesus, on the true Jesus. The real Jesus, the historical Jesus, and so on. These are all reconstructions then from the gospel of what Jesus really was like. And as this theologian said, that every picture there that these German liberal theologians painted of the real Jesus looked exactly like what that theologian saw in the mirror every morning when he got up. Because what they were doing was just reconstructing Jesus as they wanted him to be. And we know it's true, don't we? We know that's what liberalism is like. Reconstructing then the ministry of Jesus Christ to make it comfortable and easy. But we need to be aware of this danger nearer to home, don't we? There is very easy in teaching, in standing up here to preach, to bring messages which are pleasing to the congregation. That people go away at the end and say, "Oh, that was a great message. What a fantastic preacher." Why? Because he's confirmed all their pre-existing prejudices. The man has stood up, and if you've watched any of the Democratic and Republican rallies recently in the United States, you know what it's like when somebody stands up and they utter some truism and the crowd cheers. But it's exactly the kind of thing that they love. It's playing to the crowds. And we need to beware then the danger in Christian ministry of playing to our own crowd, of teaching to our own congregation here things that make us feel comfortable. I've heard people, evangelicals then on both sides, of say a creation issue. If you take creationism, the issue around then these early chapters in Genesis. And I've heard people say, evangelicals say, no true believer of God could deny that God created the world in 6 24-hour days. Now, what kind of statement is that? Well, it's a statement designed to please a certain audience with a certain preconceived view. But it also, of course, writes off so many Christians who wouldn't hold that view, and we can't just lightly dismiss because it pleases ourselves the views of other people. Or, of course, I've heard, as you will have heard, the opposite. You hear people, Christians, evangelical Christians, writing and saying, no intelligent scientist could believe that God created the world in 6 days. And I think, well, where does that leave me as a scientist today? And this kind of crowd-pleasing approach isn't helpful. And we need then to encourage a ministry that will bring teaching that doesn't just fit what we already believe, that does cause us to think, that does cause us to examine our hearts, that does make us say, I need to change, that does make us say, yes, I need to repent and change my ways, and not just have a ministry then characteristic of the false prophets, a ministry of whitewashing, a ministry of comfort and peace. So we have then in chapter 12, then the ministry of the true prophet. In chapter 13, the ministry of the false prophets and prophetesses. And in chapter 14, we have then a focus on the elders as representative of the people. In reply, in verse 14, chapter 4, when Ezekiel speaks, when the elders have come to inquire of them, Ezekiel says, when any Israelite sets up idols. So although it's the elders who come to inquire of him specifically, his ministry isn't just true of the elders of the time. What he's saying here is true of the elders and the other Israelites in exile, certainly, but also of those not currently in exile. And the idols of the hearts that Ezekiel talks about here almost certainly looks to what we were considering in chapters 8 to 11. You may remember there Ezekiel's visionary experience consisted of a series of exposures of the wicked practices of men and women in Jerusalem, many of whom, like the elders there, claimed to be orthodox, but there they were worshipping creepy crawlies in secret. There they were worshipping the sun god. And so on. And remember that those men, those elders that Ezekiel saw, they were friends of these elders who come to seek him now. They were all part of that social class in Judah. Some had been taken into exile, some were at home, but they would have been guilty of the same kinds of sinful attitudes and practices. In their hearts then, like those Jews and those Jewish leaders back in Jerusalem, these men, the elders and the people with Ezekiel, had the same idolatrous hearts, setting up these idols then that they worshipped. But what impact then, of particular importance here, is what impact did that have on prophetic ministry, which you remember is the focus here through these chapters? Well, Ezekiel says then it affected the way that they listened to prophetic ministry. It affected the way they listened to it. We've talked about the ministry of the false prophets. So these men come along with their whitewash. These women come along with their incantations and their magical charms and so on. They're paid to bring this ministry that is comfortable and easy. But this isn't something that happens in isolation, is it? The people to whom they're ministering are these people with idols in their heart. So in verse 4b, we read, when any Israelite sets up idols in his heart and puts a wicked stumbling block before his face and then goes to a prophet, here what we would call a false prophet, I, the Lord, will answer him myself in keeping with his great idolatry. I will answer him in accordance with his idolatrous heart, says the Lord. And similarly down in verses 9 and 10. If a prophet is enticed to utter a prophecy, I, the Lord, have enticed that prophet, and I will stretch out my hand against him and destroy him from among my people Israel. They will bear their guilt. The prophet will be as guilty as the one who consults him. They're both guilty. These Israelites with idols in their hearts, they want the prophets and the prophetesses to bring this whitewashed, comfortable, false ministry. It isn't that the prophets and prophetesses are in isolation. They're in collusion with the people. We had it in chapter 13 and verse 19, this collusive nature. Verse 19, chapter 13, you've profaned me among my people for a few handfuls of barley and scraps of bread. By lying to my people who listen to lies. My people who listen to lies. That's their characteristic. that these are people with idols in their hearts who listen to lies. That's what they want, because they're idols in their hearts. They don't want the truth from a man like Ezekiel. So these men then are in collusion, the elders, and the people are in collusion with the prophets. They work together then in this false ministry. And that's then a third aspect of the ministry of the false prophets, that it is collusive in nature. It's collusive in nature. That the reason people are cynical, as I said, is because deep down they don't want to listen to the truth. They don't want to discern truth from error. They want to go along with a comfortable teaching. They buy in literally to a comfortable teaching. So they collude together. But closely linked to the collusive nature, and I try to distinguish these into points 3 and 4, but they're very closely linked, is the ambiguous nature of much prophetic ministry. And again, you know this is the case all through the ages. It's the nature of kind of false prophets and prophetesses. I mean, one famous example from history is during the days of the great Persian march into Greece. And this was the time of the 300 in Thermopylae. And they were marching south, and the hordes, this huge Persian army. And the Greeks were saying, how can we possibly fight against these? Have we got any chance at all? So they went to their prophetess. They went to the Pythia at Delphi to seek the will of their god, so-called, in about 480 BC. And one of their leaders, the great Greek leader at the time, was Themistocles. And this prophetess, she uttered this extremely vague prophecy. And I forgot to bring the book to read it at length, but I've written down part of it, the key part of it, which is what she said, that the wooden wall alone shall stand. And as these Greeks returned home to Athens, and they were trying to figure, what does it mean? What is this wooden wall? And now Themistocles, this powerful Greek leader, he had always wanted a navy. He'd always wanted a navy. He said, the only chance is for us to form a great navy. So he said, the wooden wall obviously refers to ships. They're all made of woods. That is going to be our wall. But of course, the point is that the whole prophecy, like others, if you read the from the Pythia, they were so brilliantly ambiguous. Just like the ministry of good, I suppose, in inverted commas, as in clever, not as in morally good, astrologers and so on today, that they will bring something that is suitably ambiguous and allows you to place the interpretation on it that you want. So Themistocles wanted a navy, and he convinced all the Greeks then that that is what she had meant. It was ambiguous, but this goes along then with a collusive nature. They're working together to bring about an interpretation, a truth, a meaning that fits what they want it to fit. Now, when Ezekiel says this, he says, this is what the prophets are like. They're bringing these messages to suit your idolatrous hearts. Messages that you will be able to interpret as all is well, that everything is hunky-dory, and don't worry. And a classic example of this, of exactly what Ezekiel's, or the Lord through Ezekiel, saying here in verses 4 and 9 and 10 that many of you will be familiar with, is that of Micaiah to Ahab. Micaiah to King Ahab, as recorded in 1 Kings chapter 22. Ahab then is lining up in battle against the Syrians or the Aramaeans. And he's saying, you know, am I going to win? Am I going to have victory? And Micaiah is a true prophet of the Lord, as he knows. So he says, Micaiah, you know, what's going to be the outcome of this battle? And Micaiah then, under the inspiration of the Lord, brings a saying that was just typical of what the false prophets would say. Because he said literally, go up, for the Lord has given into the hands of the king. Go up, for the Lord has given into the hands of the king. So Ahab said, oh, that's great. It means the Syrian king's going to be given into my hands. And all the false prophets, they all say, yeah, that's right, you're going to be victorious. He's going to be given into your hands. But of course, it wasn't what happened, because it wasn't what, when Micaiah expanded, he said was going to happen. He said, no, you're going to be killed. That's your kind of false prophetic ministry. You're going to be victorious, or you can interpret it that way. And so false teaching, as well as being kind of comfortable in its tendency, is typically ambiguous. It is unclear. And as I say, it's then collusive by fitting the prejudices and the preconceived ideas of the congregation. And so we should look for a ministry, a true ministry, that would be clear, that we can follow, that is understandable, that doesn't leave us wondering what the point was, that doesn't leave us saying, well, what was the sermon about? That isn't like that classic example given of two men walking out from an evangelical sermon. It's probably apocryphal, but one said to the other, you know, so what did he preach on today? Because he obviously hadn't got hold of it. And the other man said, sin. And so the first man said, well, but what did he say about sin? Oh, he was against it. Aren't we all? But so much ministry can be like that. It can be so vague that you can just go away and say, well, that was a good message. But if you pin down, what did he actually say? What did it actually mean to me? What do I have to do to change? What I have learned new today? How have I had my understanding of the Lord clarified? Nothing is there. So we should pray that we have a ministry that is clear. Clear in its proclamation of the truth. Faithful, as I've said, in bringing in truth is not just comfortable, but that discomforts us, causes our minds to be open to new truths about the Lord that may shake us, causes us to be open to new truths about the Lord and his salvation that, yes, at times will lift us in praise to God. But ministry then that is not merely bland, repetitious and ambiguous, ministry that is faithful and true. And the final point then about the ministry then of these false prophets is that, as we've seen, it was overruled by the Lord. It was the Lord who caused this to happen. Just as it was the Lord who spoke through Micaiah, the Lord says very clearly here, doesn't he? You know, the sovereign Lord says, when these things happen, I, the Lord. If any prophet entices a prophecy, I, the Lord. These men are not acting outside the providential control of God. But even the ministry of false prophets is controlled, determined by the overarching plan of our God. And we, of course, know that's so. That's one of those truths that we love and we should cling on to. But we should remember that when we have these people uttering these bland prophecies and teachings and bringing these things that are comfortable and often truisms, when people bring heretical teaching, whatever it is, all these things are determined by the plan of the Lord. But that the true people of the Lord, those without idols in their hearts, can, as we've said, see the difference. I've said earlier on that it was very important whether you recognised that Ezekiel was a true man of God, or Jeremiah saying much the same back in Jerusalem. Because if you were, you would have got out. And I said earlier in this series that Ezekiel as the Son of Man is a type of Jesus Christ, the true Son of Man. I'm sure as I began the reading this evening in chapter 12, many of you were struck by the way that the people of Ezekiel's generation are described. How are they described? They have eyes to see but do not see, and ears to hear but they do not hear, for they are a rebellious people. A saying that, of course, was true time after time in what Jesus Christ taught and said about his generation. He came as the fulfillment of Ezekiel. Ezekiel, when did he minister? He ministered to prophesy the doom of Jerusalem and the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem. Jesus Christ, of course, prophesied and ministered the doom of the second temple, most clearly in his Olivet Discourse, when he said that the Romans would surround Jerusalem and raise it to the ground. Like Ezekiel, a true prophet. And whether the people in his day, Jews, recognized him as a true prophet or not, made a great difference, didn't it? Just as it did in Ezekiel's day. If they were, in his own words, his sheep, his true sheep, his people who heard his voice, then they understood that when the Roman armies marched into Judea to surround Jerusalem, they knew what to do. And Josephus tells us that the Christians fled Jerusalem in those days. The Christians remembered the teaching of the true Son of Man, and they got out from the judgment of God on Jerusalem. They escaped, they fled to the hills. They knew then that Jesus Christ, what he had said was true, and it was now being brought to fulfillment. Many years after Jesus had prophesied it, many more years, in fact, than Ezekiel's doom for Jerusalem was fulfilled. But the true men and women of God, the true Christians in the Lord's day, they understood. They were his sheep. They listened to his voice. They were keen to distinguish true prophets from the many false prophets ministering. If you read in Josephus, you read of the false prophets in those days in and around Jerusalem saying, all is well. All will be well. We're all going to be saved. God will deliver us, just as the false prophets did in Ezekiel's day. Just as they whitewashed, so they did in the Lord's, to the Lord's ministry. May the Lord then help all of us as true people of God, to be true people of God, who will hear Jesus' voice, who will seek true teaching, be able to distinguish it from false teaching, and be willing to accept teaching when it is clear and plain and painful as ministry from the Lord for our benefit. Amen.